Hi everybody, as I'm sure you can see, I'm not in my usual setup. I'm not at my house, I'm on the road. Well, the video is not great, but hopefully this microphone that I picked up today does a decent job on the audio. And what I would like to do is to walk through a piece of writing with you by Giorgio Agamben on Derrida called Pardes, The Writing of Potentiality. So we're not going to give a lot of introductory commentary here. Let's just launch into it. And I should say one thing about it, which is that I've been teaching in private tutoring Heidegger and Derrida in relationship to language and mysticism. And this essay came up. It refers to a story in the Jewish sources about four rabbis who go to paradise. And I've always been attracted by that story because there's a rabbi there who goes in and goes out in peace. You know, that doesn't happen to the other rabbis. They either get lost or they lose their mind or they're never heard from again. And I've always liked the idea that if you're going to explore the mysteries, if you're going to go into the forbidden places, and if you're going to have something like a beatific vision or you're going to aspire to one, that you should come in peace and go in peace. So I like that rabbi, Rabbi Akiva. But a student that I've been working with reminded me, or first told me and then reminded me, that Agamben has used the image of Pardes or of paradise, so this parable of the four rabbis, in order to say something about Derrida, Derrida's manner of writing and thinking and his relationship to, in some sense, the great mysteries or to the holy or to paradise. And I never actually have gone over this essay from scratch all by itself, but I want to do that and I want to do it together with you. So let's do it. Okay, I'm reading this for the first time, even though I've had it referred to on another occasion. So Pardes, the writing of potentiality. Pardes, here we go. The second chapter of the Talmudic treatise Haggigah, literally offering, considers those matters that it is permitted to study and those that must not in any case become objects of investigation. The Mishnah, with which the chapter opens, reads as follows. Okay, so now he's quoting a Mishnah from the Talmudic treatise, Haggigah, second chapter. Okay, if you don't know what all those words mean, don't worry about it. Try to just zero in on the substance of what's being said, if that's even possible. Let's try. Forbidden relationships must not be explained in the presence of three people. The work of creation must not be explained in the presence of two people. The chariot, Merkaba, the chariot of Ezekiel's vision, which is the symbol of mystical knowledge, must not be explained in the presence of one, unless he is a sage who already knows it on his own. It is better never to have been born than to be someone who investigates into the four things. The four things are what is above, what is below, what is first, and what is after. And then parenthetically, that is the object of mystical knowledge, but also metaphysical knowledge, which claims to study the supernatural origin of things. Now, end quote here from the Mishnah. By the way, we could stop, I think, and talk for a long time about what's said there in relationship to philosophy, in relationship to Platonism, to Socrates, to what we learn about Socrates, not only from Plato, but first and foremost, Aristophanes. But let's continue with the essay, okay? At 14b, we find the following story, which marks the beginning of a brief cycle of agadot, I'll call them stories, concerning Elisha ben Abuya, who is called Aher, literally the other, after having sinned. So now we're reading this story, okay? The one that I referred to in my opening remarks. Four rabbis entered Pardes, Ben Azai, Ben Zoma, Aher, and Rabbi Akiba. Rabbi Akiba said, "When you reach the stones of pure marble, do not say, 'Water, water,' for it has been said that he who says what is false will not be placed before my eyes." Ben Azai cast a glance and died. Of him scripture says, "Precious to the eyes of the Lord is the death of his saints." Ben Zoma looked and went mad. Of him scripture says, Have you found honey? Eat as much as you can, otherwise you will be full and you will vomit. Ahir cut the branches. Rabbi Akiva left unharmed. Okay, so four rabbis entered parties. One, Rabbi Akiva leaves unharmed. Ahir cut the branches. Ben Zoma looked and went mad. Ben Azai cast a glance and died. According to rabbinical tradition, pardes, garden, paradise, signifies supreme knowledge. In the Kabbalah, the Shekhinah, the presence of God, is thus called pardes HaTorah, the paradise of the Torah. That is, its fullness, its fulfilled revelation. This Gnostic interpretation of the term paradise is common to many heretical movements, both Christian and Jewish. Almeric of Ben, whose followers were burnt at the stake on November 12th, 1210, stated that paradise is the knowledge of truth, and we should await no other. Excuse me for a moment. The entry of the four rabbis into pardes is therefore a figure for access to supreme knowledge. And the Agadah contains a parable on the mortal risks inherent in this access. What, from this perspective, is the significance, Agamben now asks, of the cutting of the branches attributed to Ahir in the context of Ben Azai's death and Ben Zoma's madness? Okay, so, you know, you understand, right? One person died, one person went mad, Rabbi Akiva left, but what about the one who cut the branches? What does that mean? We do not know for certain, Agamben writes, but the Kabbalah identifies the cutting of the branches with the gravest sin that can be committed on the road to knowledge. This sin is defined as isolation of the Shekhinah and consists in the separation of the Shekhinah from the other Sefirot. Now, by the way, if you don't know anything about Jewish terminology, anything about these figures, the Shekhinah is kind of like the exiled glory of God, okay? The holy presence or dwelling of God. It's complicated. Okay, a mystical figure. And the Sefirot are, in Kabbalistic literature, this is me now talking, not Agamben, they are, if you've ever seen, or if you want to just search and you will see, the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, the circles are the Sefirot, okay? There's a long history of interpretation of them. So the sin of the cutting of the branches, the gravest sin that can be committed on the road to knowledge, is defined as isolation of the Shekhinah and consists in the separation of the Shekhinah from the other Sefirot and in the comprehension of it as an autonomous power. Okay, so even if you don't understand the mystical side of it, the sin has to do with isolation, isolating apart, and treating it as autonomous. As an autonomous power. For the Kabbalists, the Shekhinah is the last of the 10 Sefirot, that is the attributes or words of God, and it is the one that expresses the divine presence itself, God's manifestation or dwelling on earth. In cutting the branches, that is the other Sefirot, Ahir separates the knowledge and revelation of God from the other aspects of divinity. It is therefore not an accident if in other texts the cutting of branches is identified with the sin of Adam, who instead of contemplating the totality of the Sefirot, you could say the totality of God, of God's complete, as much as possible of the absoluteness of God in the Godhead, let's say. Okay, instead of contemplating the totality of the Sefirot, Adam preferred to contemplate only the last one, which seemed in itself to represent all the others. In this way, he separated the tree of knowledge from the tree of life. The Ahir-Adam analogy is significant. Like Adam, Ahir, the other, okay, in other words, remember what he said at the beginning, Ahir means other. Like Adam, Ahir, the quote-unquote other, represents humanity insofar as he isolates knowledge, which is nothing other than the fulfilled form of divine manifestation from the other Sephirot in which divinity shows itself, making knowledge into his own destiny and specific power. Once again, let me just interject here. The simplest way of understanding what Agamben is saying here in layman's terms about the isolation of the Sephirot is it's idolizing knowledge as an autonomous power, isolating and idolizing a part of the picture and leaving out the other parts of the whole of the divine, of the realm of the divine. Okay? To repeat, the Aher-Adam analogy is significant. Like Adam, Aher, the other represents humanity insofar as he isolates knowledge, which is nothing other than the fulfilled form of divine manifestation, from the other Sephirot in which divinity shows itself, making knowledge into his own destiny and specific power. In this condition of exile, the Shekhinah loses its powers and becomes maleficent, with a striking image the Kabbalists say that it sucks the milk of evil. Next section title, Exile. Moses of Leon, the author of the Zohar, a mystical text in the Jewish tradition, offers us a different interpretation of the story of the four rabbis. According to his reading, now those of you who are just listening and not watching, I'm smoking a cigar, okay, as we talk, and the more I talk, the more the cigar goes out, so excuse me for one moment here. Moses of Leon, the author of the Zohar, offers us a different interpretation of the story of the four rabbis. According to his reading, the Agadah, okay, this tale, okay, Agadah, for our purposes, story, tale. The Agadah, the one about Pardes, is in truth a parable on the exegesis of the sacred text, and more precisely on the four senses of scripture. Each of the four consonants of the word, Pardes, refers to one of the senses. P stands for Pshat, the literal sense. Okay, so every text has these four senses, or let's say scripture at least has these four senses. They're represented by the letters P, R, D, S. And together we put those letters and we get the word Pardes or paradise. But what do the letters stand for? P stands for Pshat, the literal sense. R stands for Ramez, the allegorical sense. D stands for Darasha, Talmudic interpretation. And S stands for Sod, the mystical sense. Correspondingly, in the Tukenei HaZohar, each of the four rabbis incarnates one level of interpretation. Ben Azai, who enters and dies, is the literal sense. Ben Zoma is the Talmudic sense. Aher is the allegorical sense. And Akiba, my favorite, who enters and leaves unharmed, is the mystical sense. How, from this perspective, is one to understand Aher's sin? In the cutting of the branches and the isolation of the Shekhinah, we can see a moral risk implicit in every act of interpretation, in every confrontation with a text or discourse, whether human or divine. This risk is that speech, which is nothing other than the manifestation and the unconcealment of something, may be separated from what it reveals and acquire an autonomous consistency. It is significant that the Zohar elsewhere defines the isolation of the Shekhinah as a separation of the word from the voice, the Sephirah Tiferet. The cutting of the branches is therefore an experimentum linguae, an experience of language that consists in separating speech both from the voice and a pronunciation and from its reference. It's very interesting. Let me just pause for a minute. Full credit to the person I was talking with in my school about this topic when this essay came to mind for him, because we were talking precisely about the fact that in Heidegger, the word seems to have a kind of magical or mystical power, but that in Heidegger, it doesn't culminate in word magic, in the manipulation of letters, in the kind of things you can do with chaos magic. Okay, it doesn't invest the letters themselves and the words themselves with an autonomous spiritual power. They serve as a sort of vehicle for the conveyance of the truth of being. And you see here that Agamben is saying, well, if you do cut them off from the conveyance of meaning or of a truth, or if you no longer have them as bearers of something, if you separate them, if you isolate them, and if you make them autonomous, then you are caught up in one of the risks of interpretation, one of the risks in every confrontation with a text or discourse. Okay, so the cutting of the branches is therefore an experience of language that consists in separating speech both from the voice and pronunciation and from its reference. By the way, I have to say one more thing. I've been reading War and Peace, and there's a nice passage in War and Peace about how some people were doing this with the name of Napoleon, and doing a sort of numerical analysis of his name and using that to predict his reign and so on. But okay, let's go back here. A pure word isolated in itself with neither voice nor referent, with its semantic value indefinitely suspended, this is the dwelling of Aher, the other, in paradise. This is why he can neither perish in paradise by adhering to meaning, like Benzoma and Ben Azai, nor leave unharmed, like Rabbi Akiba or Akiva. He fully experiences the exile of the Shekinah, that is, human language. Of him, the Talmud says he will not be judged, nor will he enter into the world to come. Now, that's interesting for reasons that we probably can't go into, but, you know, with this other student, I had been discussing Giorgio Agamben's Homo Sacer. And there's a figure, again, a long story, I don't want to bore you with the details, it would take us some time to go into them, but there's a figure who's kind of, in some way, neither here nor there. He's exiled, but he's still within the land of his exile. So he's no longer under the law, but he's still kind of in the system of law, but outside of it. Okay, so one of the things Agamben says about him, and as I say, we're not going into the details, okay? But he has this characteristic, Homo Sacer does, this figure, this strange figure at the source of sovereignty for Agamben, that he can be killed without it being a homicide or a sacrifice. So he's somehow suspended out of both human and divine law. And I see something of that in this passage that Agamben finds in the Talmud, that he will not be judged, nor will he enter into the world to come. So somehow he doesn't fall under the human law where he would be judged, but he's also not allowed into the divine world. Okay, but that's again, just in passing for those of you who know more Agamben than I do. Okay, next section is called Terminus. Benjamin once wrote that terminology is the proper element of thought, and that for every philosopher, the terminus in itself encloses the nucleus of a system. In Latin, terminus means limit, border. It was originally the name of a divinity who was still represented in the classical age as an anthropomorphous figure, whose body gradually faded away into a dot firmly planted on the ground. In medieval logic, which transmitted the words current sense to modern languages, a quote-unquote term was a word that did not signify itself, but instead stood for the thing it signified, referring to something. According to this conception, a thought without terms, a thought unfamiliar with a point at which thought ceases to refer to itself and is firmly grounded on the soil of reference, is not a philosophical thought. Occam, the head of the school of philosophers usually defined as terminists, therefore excluded from terms in the strict sense conjunctions, adverbs, and other syncategoramatic expressions. In the terminology of modern philosophy, it is no longer possible to maintain either the clear opposition between self-reference and reference, or the exclusion of those syncategoramic terms, if that is one admits that it ever was. It was already impossible to say whether certain fundamental terms of Kantian thought, such as the transcendental object and the thing in itself, were referential or self-referential. Since Kant, moreover, the terminological relevance of such expressions has been steadily growing. Pewter thus noted the importance of the adverb gleichwohl in the articulation of Kantian philosophy, and in his Marburg lectures of summer 1927, Heidegger called attention to the frequency of the adverb schon and this word's relevance for the proper determination of the problem of temporality. Even a simple punctuation mark can acquire a terminological character. The strategic importance of hyphens in being in time, as in the expression being hyphen in hyphen the hyphen world, thus did not escape an observer as attentive as Carl Lewith. In other words, okay, here, just very simply restated, terms are words with a reference outside themselves, and dashes can be terms because for Heidegger, the dashes in being in the world have a reference outside of language. They refer to the structure of our existence. If it is true that, as has been efficiently stated, terminology is the poetry of thought, this displacement and transformation of the properly poetic moment of thought undoubtedly characterizes contemporary philosophy. More pauses here between the sentences. I'm sorry, but this is the kind of essay that I wouldn't mind, especially after a long day, you know, enjoying my cigar with. Okay, so this does not mean that philosophical terms have lost their specific sense, and that abandoning its name-giving gesture, philosophy has therefore become indistinguishable from literature and has been returned to the conversation of humanity, as some have argued. Philosophical terms remain names, but their referential character can no longer be understood simply according to the traditional scheme of signification. It now implies a different and decisive experience of language. Terms indeed become the place of a genuine experimentum linguae. This crisis in the etymological sense of terminology is the proper situation of thought today, and Derrida is the philosopher who has perhaps most radically taken this situation into account. His thought interrogates and calls into question precisely the terminological moment, hence the properly poetic moment of thinking, exposing its crisis. Okay, so if you got lost, I understand. If you're still here, I'm surprised. But let's see. So you have, to go back, you have the interpretation of the four rabbis of Pardes in terms of the four levels of interpretation. You have the cutting of the branches on the third level, the allegorical. And you have the idea that cutting the branches means, in some sense, isolating a word from its referent. I'm simplifying, okay? And that the kind of the problem involved in reference and self-reference of words, okay, the crisis of terminology is saturating thought today. And the one who's most radically understood this situation is Derrida. So now we're going to have a connection here between Derrida and the cutting of the branches. And hopefully that gives us some insight into, as I said earlier, the relationship between language and mysticism, using Derrida and Agamben as our guides. His thought, Derrida's thought, interrogates and calls into question precisely the terminological moment, hence the properly poetic moment of thinking, exposing its crisis. This explains the success of deconstruction in contemporary philosophy, as well as the polemics that surround it. Deconstruction suspends the terminological character of philosophical vocabulary, rendered indeterminate terms seem to float interminably in the ocean of sense. This is not, of course, an operation accomplished by deconstruction of our capriciousness or unnatural violence. On the contrary, precisely this calling into question of philosophical terminology constitutes deconstruction's insuperable contemporaneity. Okay, again, if that's too unnecessarily verbose for you, again, we just have the point here that Derrida of all thinkers and deconstruction of all movements, quote, suspends the terminological character of philosophical vocabulary, therefore puts us before the question. Nevertheless, it would be the worst misunderstanding of Derrida's gesture to think it could be exhausted in a deconstructive use of philosophical terms that would simply consign them to an infinite wandering or interpretation. Although he calls into question the poetico-terminological moment of thinking, Derrida does not abdicate its naming power. He still calls by names, as when Spinoza says, by causa sui, I understand, or when Leibniz writes the monad, of which we will speak here. Okay, so Derrida calls into question the terminological moment, but he doesn't abdicate naming power. He still calls out, calls forth, calls to, with the use of names. For Derrida, there is certainly a philosophical terminology, but the status of this terminology has wholly changed, or more exactly, has revealed the abyss on which it always rested. Like Ahare, Derrida enters into the paradise of language where terms touch their limits. And like Ahare, he cuts the branches. He experiences the exile of terminology, its paradoxical subsistence in the isolation of all univocal reference. But what is at issue in the terms of Derrida's thought? What is named by a philosophical terminology that no longer wants to refer to something, and yet at the same time, above all experiences, the fact that there are names? What can be the meaning of a terminus in terminatus? And if all thought defines itself above all through a certain experience of language, what is the experimentum linguae of Derrida's terminology? Okay, if you happen to be one of those kinds of people who enjoy this sort of examination, then I'm very glad to be spending my time with you. And if you're not, and you're still here out of some sense of curiosity, well, I commend you for your intellectual fortitude. Let's go on, though. Okay, Nomen in Nomabile, the title of this section. Derrida himself has often defined the status of his own terminology. In the three passages that follow, the status is determined as non-name, as undecidable, and as trace. Quoting now Derrida, "For us, difference remains a metaphysical name, and all the names that it receives in our language are still as names metaphysical. Older than being itself, such a difference has no name in our language. But we already know that if it is unnameable, it is provisionally so, not because our language has not yet found or received this name, or because we would have to seek it in another language." Guys, I'm going to pause this really quickly. Let me read it, and then we'll go over it again and try to make some sense of it, okay? "We already know that if it is unnameable, it is provisionally so, not because our language has not yet found or received this name, or because we would have to seek it in another language. It is rather because there is no name for it at all, not even the name of essence or of being, not even that of difference, which is not a name, which is not a pure nominal unity and unceasingly dislocates itself in a chain of differing and deferring substitutions. This unnameable is not an ineffable being, which no name could approach, God, for example. This unnameable is the play which makes possible nominal effects, the relatively unitary and atomic structures that are called names, the chains of substitutions of names in which, for example, the nominative effect difference is itself meshed, carried off, reinscribed." We're going to continue the quote in a second, but I got to tell you. It can be tempting, I think, and by the way, I had a long period where this was the case for me, when I was really frustrated with Derrida, I thought he had nothing to offer and opposed reading him with all my might, but didn't give up. A phase that thankfully I overcame, because now I learn a lot when reading him. It can be tempting to think, when you hear Derrida writing, that he's just, let's say, playing word games, okay? He's just playing word games, and that what he's saying is nonsensical or something like that. That it's, it's just some sort of quote-unquote mental masturbation, okay? But done here in the pure medium of language. Well, that's not quite right. And I want to remind you of a basic fact. And the basic fact is that whether you're dealing with, as it were, orthodox theology, or whether you're dealing with mystical theology, there has always been an intimate relationship between how we think about language and how we think about God, between what can be thought of God and said of God, between the positive attribution of characteristics to God, or the idea that you can approach God through the operation of saying he's not anything that can be ascribed to him. You know, so there's that negative theology, which of course is a negation that takes place in language, a negation of the ascription of attributes to him, let's say. Okay, so Derrida knows this. Derrida is well aware of this. Derrida has even written about the kinship between a deconstruction and negative theology or apophatic mysticism. So you should know what may strike you as mere wordplay can actually be treated, if we have the intention to benefit from it, to learn from it, and to have it open up onto, you know, deeper vistas for us. We can treat it as a thoughtful reflection on that proximity of language to divinity, which I think is in part why Agamben can use that image from the Jewish tradition of paradise and the rabbis, which is it's a mystical image in itself with a mystical layer to it, you know, the akiva representing the mystical layer of interpretation of texts, and directly relating that to language, because those are not necessarily two separate domains. They're two very intimately intertwined domains, if not two sides of one Mobius strip, or whatever is the right image there. So now we can return back to Derrida's quote here and make sure that, again, we don't treat it as some sort of trivial remarks on, you know, where he's just having fun writing. Okay, so henceforth, Derrida continues, in order better to mark this interval, it has been necessary to analyze, to set to work within the text of the history of philosophy, as well as within the so-called literary text, certain marks that by analogy I, Derrida, have called undecidables, that is, unities of simulacrum, false verbal properties, nominal or semantic, that can no longer be included within philosophical binary opposition, but which, however, inhabit philosophical opposition, resisting and disorganizing it without ever constituting a third term. It is a question of remarking a nerve, a fold, an angle that interrupts totalization in a certain place, a place of well-determined form. No series of semantic valences can any longer be closed or reassembled. Not that it opens onto an inexhaustible wealth of meaning or the transcendence of a semantic excess. By means of this angle, this fold, this doubled fold of an undecidable, a mark marks both the marked and the mark. Again, I have to interrupt here because I know if you haven't already tuned out, you might be tuning out here. Something that's neither this nor that, but that's at play in this and that, but that isn't just another this or that. Okay? The writing which, at this moment, remarks itself, something completely other than a representation of itself, can no longer be counted on the list of themes. It is not a theme and can in no case become one. It must be subtracted from, hollow, and added to relief the list. So, in other words, interrupting here Derrida once more, it has this very undecidable space. You know, interestingly here too, both subtracted from and added to, also has the kind of structure of the homo sacer figure in, but anyways, okay, I think that this and that was the simplest way that I can put it in my terms on the spot. So continuing with the quote, the relationship between the two texts, between presence in general and that which exceeds it, such a relationship can never offer itself in order to be read in the form of a presence. Supposing that anything ever can offer itself in order to be read in such a form. Okay, here, let me interject one more time, if it's helpful for you to think about this very, like, loosely, but hopefully helpfully. Think about the image of the cave, the allegory of the cave in Plato's Republic. What do you have at the somehow pinnacle of the vision? Well, let's call two peaks. Okay, one peak is where you have the intellectual apprehension of the ideas, the most beingful beings. And the other peak is where you have the apprehension of the idea of the good. But the idea of the good is said to be beyond being. So on one hand, you have the most beingful beings, the ideas. On the other, you have that which is beyond being. And in some sense, you could treat that here. We're going to map it onto Derrida really quickly. The ideas are what's present, what's most present, what's most real, what's the reality of the real. And nevertheless, they're somehow empowered by that which is beyond presence or not presence. Okay, the beyond being is how Plato puts it in the Republic, how it's written in the Republic. And then the question is, can the relationship between the most beingful beings and that which is beyond being, can that relationship between presence and somehow that which is not presence or exceeds it, not in the direction of nothingness, but somehow in the direction of more, I think Derrida, someone calls it quote unquote hyperbolic, okay, it's more than the most, something like that, can that relationship itself be treated as presence? Can the relationship between the beingful beings and that which is beyond being be treated as an idea itself? Okay, idea in the Platonic sense. So it's a complicated, you know, listen, these are, we're not doing here philosophy 101, okay? These are not at all straightforward thoughts to think, and yet, you know, they're worth thinking. So that was my restatement here of the relationship between the two texts, between presence in general and that which exceeds it. Such a relationship can never offer itself in order to be read in the form of presence. Okay, that's what I just tried to map for you in the language of Plato's cave allegory. Supposing that anything ever can offer itself in order to be read in such a form. And yet, that which gives us to think beyond the closure cannot be simply absent. So like I said, it's somehow it's not present, but it's also not simply absent. It's in play, but it's not in play as the thing that's there, okay? Absent, either it would give us nothing to think, or it still would be a negative mode of presence. Therefore, the sign of this excess, this hyperbolic, this more than the most, okay, this beyond presence, the sign of this excess must be absolutely excessive as concerns all possible presence absence. So in being more than the most, it's also more than the distinction between presence and absence, so to speak. Okay, it must be absolutely excessive as concerns all possible presence absence, all possible production or disappearance of beings in general, and yet in some manner it must still signify in a manner unthinkable by metaphysics as such. Again, anybody who's even a little bit, I think, familiar with mysticism has to see already, sense, or see a structural similarity. You know, this is like the movement from the god of light to the god of darkness. The movement from the god of the Sephiroth to the god of Ein Sof. Okay, the movement from, I don't know, one set of authors to another, to the Pseudo-Dionysus, the Areopagite, and all of that, if I pronounce that correctly. All right, so where are we here? We ended on the word metaphysics. Let me find it here. In order to exceed metaphysics, oh, and I have to say again, who else was interested in the problem of exceeding metaphysics? You know, the most important figure on this topic for Derrida is Martin Heidegger. In order to exceed metaphysics, it is necessary that a trace be inscribed within the text of metaphysics. A trace that continues to signal not in the direction of another presence or another form of presence, but in the direction of entirely other text, of an entirely other text. You know, in Heidegger's contributions to philosophy of the event, which I've been teaching, have with me in my backpack here, he calls that the resonating. Something resonates within metaphysics, and to shift back and forth from Heideggerian to Derridian language, what resonates, okay, shifting the metaphor here, is the trace. But it's not the resonance of metaphysics within metaphysics. It's the resonance or the trace of something other in metaphysics. So again, in order to exceed metaphysics, it is necessary that a trace be inscribed within the text of metaphysics, a trace that continues to signal not in the direction of another presence or another form of presence, but in the direction of entirely other text. Okay, this is kind of like the, I'm so tempted to theologize, but I'll let Agamben do it. The mode of inscription of such a trace in the text of metaphysics is so unthinkable that it must be described as an erasure of the trace itself. Okay, maybe that's akin in some sense to what Heidegger calls concealment, to the fact that being stays away. But we're somehow aware of it staying away, and yet, okay, erasure of the trace itself. The trace is produced as its own erasure. Again, these are all Derrida's ways of trying to say, how can it be there and not be there? And yet it must somehow be there for us without being there and be there for us while not being there, okay? It belongs to the trace to erase itself, to elude that which might maintain it in presence. The trace is neither perceptible nor imperceptible. Presence, then, far from being, as is commonly thought, what the sign signifies, what a trace refers to, presence, then, is the trace of the trace of the erasure of the trace. Okay, wow, that was a long, uncharacteristically long. I mean, usually when you read books and you have quotations of other authors, they're not necessarily a page-long quotation, but this was Agamben giving us Derrida in his own terms, saying something about the status of his terminology, where, to, you know, repeat the problem, you have an experience of language where you do have terms, but they no longer want to refer to something and yet remain names. So my way of restating that is, this is for purposes of comprehension, is that here, you know, you're in the mystical experience of language. Okay, the next section is called Paradoxes. What status, Agamben asks, is ascribed to the term in these three dense passages? First of all, the non-name difference, like Derrida's other terms, does not refer to something unnameable or ineffable, a quid, something, beyond language for which names would be lacking. What is unnameable is that there are names, the play which makes possible nominal effects, as Derrida put it. What is nameless yet in some way signified is the name itself. That is why the point from which every interpretation of Derrida's terminology must depart, its literal sense, to take up the Kabbalistic exegesis of the Agadah of Aher, is its self-referential structure. The sign of this excess must be absolutely excessive as concerns all possible presence-absence. Okay, Agamben re-quoting that passage in Derrida that we looked at as well. All possible production or disappearance of beings in general, and yet in some manner it must still signify. By means of this angle, this fold, this doubled fold of an undecidable, a mark marks both the marked and the mark. Deprived of its referential power and its unequivocal reference to an object, the term still in some manner signifies itself. It is self-referential. In this sense, even Derrida's undecidables, even if they are such only by analogy, are inscribed in the domain of the paradoxes of self-reference that have marked the crisis of the logic of our time. Like, does the set of all sets that don't contain themselves contain itself? I guess. And so on. Here it is possible to observe the insufficiency of the manner in which both philosophical and linguistic reflection have generally understood the problem of self-reference. This manner owes much to the medieval distinction between intentio prima and intentio secunda. In medieval logic, an intentio prima is a sign that signifies not another sign or an intentio, but an object. It is a referential term. An intentio secunda is instead a sign that signifies an intentio prima. But what does it mean to signify a sign, to intend an intentio? How is it possible to intend an intentio without turning it into an object, an intentum? Are the two modes, first and second of intentio, truly homogeneous? Do they differ only with regard to their object? The insufficiency here consists in the fact that intentio secunda, the intention of a sign, is thought according to the scheme of intentio prima, reference to an object. Self-reference is thus referred to the acoustic or graphic consistency of the word, that is, to the identity of the term as an object, the suppositio materialis of medieval logicians. There is thus, properly speaking, no self-reference, since the term signifies a segment of the world and not intentionality itself. What is understood is not truly an intentio, but a thing, an intentum. Okay, so what's the upshot of what he just said? The upshot is, to repeat, that in that model, there's no self-reference, properly speaking. Only if one abandons this first level of self-referentiality, or rather pseudo-self-referentiality, does one reach the heart of the problem. So what he just described doesn't get us to the heart. What he's about to describe, I guess, does move us there. But, to continue with Agamben's words, everything for that very reason is then complicated. And if you're into this video 44 minutes in, you see that it's been complicated from the start. For there to be the signification of an intentionality and not of an object, it is necessary that the term signify but signify itself only insofar as it signifies. It is thus necessary that the intentio be neither a referent nor, for that matter, simply referred to an object, in the semiotic scheme by which aliquid stat pro aliquo, something stands for something else, A stands for B, the intentio cannot indicate the first something or the second. It must rather, above all, refer to the standing for itself. The aporia of Derrida's terminology, and if you've ever read Derrida, you know there's shot through with it. The aporia of Derrida's terminology is that in it, one standing for stands for another standing for, without anything like an objective referent constituting itself in its presence. But accordingly, the very notion of sense, of standing for, then enters into a state of crisis. This is the root of the particular terseness of Derrida's terminology. Okay, look, you know, you have very simply stated two ways that you could treat the frustration of Derrida's writing. One is just to throw up your arms in despair, which I have done before, and maybe you're doing now if you didn't do it at the, you know, onset or outset of this video. But another is just to slog through it, okay, and to try to figure out what the hell is going on. So Agamben has done that to some extent, and he's tried to get us to the root of the particular terseness of Derrida's terminology. But of course, we're not done yet. For an intention to refer to itself and not to an object, it must exhaust itself neither in the pure presence of an intentum nor in its absence. But the status of Derrida's terminology therefore follows coherently from the notion of trace as it is elaborated in this other text, Speech and Phenomena, and of Grammatology. Okay, two writings by Derrida. In its inaugural gesture, the grammatological project appeared above all as a destruction of the concept of the sign and as a liberation of semiotics in which the self-identity of the signified retreats and is infinitely dislocated. In Derrida, the irreducible character of signification implies the impossibility of the extinction of the signifier in the voice, grounding the Western conception of truth. Okay. Do we have to say something about that? In short, you could say, okay, just summarizing very, very briefly. If, you know, A standing for B is one model of thinking, in Derrida's model where a standing for stands for another standing for, you're outside of the realm of A stands for B. Okay, you have some other kind of thing going on here because you have the, quote, extinction of the signifier in the voice. Therefore, the impossibility of what had been taken as the somehow only possibility. Trace names precisely this inextinguishable instance of representamen in every presence, this excess of signification in all sense. Will you guys permit me to go completely off topic here for a minute? Well, not completely, but you know, I have a hobby of making music, or I used to. I haven't really made much recently. And I have a song called Old Europe, in which when I was writing it, which I don't really write, I just hit record, play whatever comes out of my mouth and wrap it up. But there's a line there inspired by, I must have been reading Derrida at the time, inspired by the trace in Derrida's thought. Okay, so that's just a little mystery for posterity. Maybe 100 years from now, somebody will dig it up. Trace names precisely that, this excess of signification in all sense. To return to the terms of medieval logic, there can be neither an intentio prima nor an intentio secunda. Every intention is always secunda prima or prima secunda, such that in it intentionality always exceeds intent and signification, always anticipates and survives the signified. Okay, once again, this and that need this, but it's not this or that. You know, this weird implication in language and of language that allows somehow for speaking, but is in this weird aporetic state. That was me trying to clarify by means of things that are equally unclear. This is why Agamben writes, now quoting Derrida, the trace is not only the disappearance of the origin, it means that the origin did not even disappear, that it was never constituted except reciprocally by a non-origin, the trace, which thus becomes the origin of the origin. Okay, so the origin doesn't come first, it comes second. That's my comment, as it were. From then on, to wrench the concept of the trace from the classical scheme, which would deprive it from a presence or from an originary non-trace, excuse me, derive it, okay, pardon me, which would derive it from a presence or from an originary non-trace, and which would make of it an empirical mark. One must indeed speak of an originary trace or architrace, yet we know that the concept destroys its name, and that if it begins with the trace, there's above all no originary trace. Okay, I'm going to put it again, restated in terms that are only roughly appropriate. You know the saying, where there's smoke, there's fire? Well, Derrida wants us to see sort of how there's smoke but no fire. There's a trace, but it's not derived from an origin. And somehow, even if you infer the fire from the smoke, you can't even say the smoke came first somehow, because the trace is not just, he wants to guard us against making the trace a thing-like thing. Number one in the list of thing-like things. Okay, it's not number one. The smoke is not number one. And yet somehow there's smoke, but no fire. And it's not because you put the fire out. The fire was never kindled. Okay, again, it sounds crazy. It seems like meaningless, trivial language game, maybe. But it is right at the strange heart of reflection on not only language, but again, I would say for our purposes, and apparently for Agamben's purposes, language and divinity, language and religious text, the experience of language and the experience of God. Strange to say. Grammatology was forced to become deconstruction in order to avoid this paradox, or more precisely, to seek to dwell in it correctly. This is why it renounced any attempt to proceed by decisions about meaning. But in its original intention, grammatology is not a theory of polysemy or a doctrine of the transcendence of meaning. It has as its object not an equally inexhaustible infinite hermeneutics of signification, but a radicalization of the problem of self-reference that calls into question and transforms the very concept of meaning grounding Western logic. From this perspective, the central paradox of grammatology, the concept trace is not a concept, okay, that's the central paradox of grammatology, strikingly recalls the paradox that Frege in 1892 stated in Object and Concept, and which was the first sign of the crisis that a few years later shook the edifice of formal logic. The concept horse is not a concept. Frege's paradox, as defined in a recent book by, wiping ash off the table and accidentally swiped the wrong way on the, anyway, give me 1 second. What did we have? We'll go with horse. Okay, we're back, yeah? Let's go back here. Sorry, guys, give me 1 second. Where are we here? Whoops. Four uses of the word horse in this text. Let's go right to the one we need. Here we go. So Frege's paradox consists in the fact that every time we name a concept, instead of using it as a predicate in a proposition, it ceases to function as a concept and appears as an object. We think we mean an object, but instead we are naming an object. We intend an intentio, but we find ourselves before an intentum. Frege's paradox is thus the consequence of a more general principle that can be stated in the following fashion. A term cannot refer to something and at the same time refer to the fact that it refers to it. Or, taking up the White Knight's line in Through the Looking Glass, the name of the name is not the name. It is worth noting that this White Knight's theorem lies at the basis of both Wittgenstein's thesis, according to which we cannot express through language what expresses itself in language, and Milner's linguistic axiom, the linguistic term has no proper name. In each case, what is essential is that if I want to say an intentio, to name the name, I will no longer be able to distinguish between word and thing, concept and object, term and its reference. As Reach showed, for Carnap's attempt to name the name through quotation marks, and as is implicit in Gödel's theorem, the logician's expedients to avoid the consequences of this radical anonymity of the name are destined to fail. It does not suffice, however, to underline on the basis of Gödel's theorem the necessary relation between a determinate axiomatics and undecidable propositions. What is decisive is solely how one conceives this relation. It is possible to consider an undecidable as a purely negative limit, Kant's shrank, such that one then invokes strategies, Bertrand Russell's theory of types or Alfred Tarski's metalanguage, to avoid running up against it. Or one can consider it a threshold, Kant's grenze, which opens onto an exteriority and transforms and dislocates all the elements of the system. Again, if you don't know all those references, that's fine. Let's just focus on the key thing. What is decisive is how one conceives this relation, the relationship between a determinant axiomatics and undecidable propositions. That is why the notion of trace constitutes the specific achievement of Derrida's thought. He does not limit himself to reformulating logical paradoxes. Rather, like Heidegger, who in On the Way to Language wrote, "There is no word for the word," and proposed an experience of language in which language itself came to language. You see, Heidegger, Derrida, language mysticism. Derrida makes these paradoxes into the place of an experiment in which the very notion of sense must be transformed and must give way to the concept of trace. But why does the attempt to name the name now take the form of a writing without presence and without absence, without history, without cause, without arche, without telos, absolutely dislocating all dialectics, all theology, all teleology, all ontology? What is the nature of Derrida's experimentum linguae if it must have the form of writing? Okay, now bear with me for 1 second because I didn't even look to see how long this essay is before I decided to read it with you. And I've had a long day and it's late. This is great, but I got to know what we're in for here. Oh, that's very manageable. Okay, a few more pages. We will go through them together now. So the section now called Scribe. The late Byzantine lexicon that goes under the name of Suda contains in the entry Aristotle the following definition. Aristotle was the scribe of nature who dipped his pen in thought. Okay, Aristoteles tes fusios grammateos anton kalamon apobrechon eis nun. Aristotle was the scribe of nature who dipped his pen in thought. In a slightly altered form, this definition, okay, the scribe of nature, this definition had already appeared in Cassiodorus and was then passed on to Beda and Isidore of Seville, where it characterized not the scribe of nature, but instead Aristotle the logician. Aristoteles quando peri, well, I'll just read it to you in English. When he wrote of interpretation, Aristotle dipped his pen in thought. Okay, so in the first one, Aristotle was the scribe of nature who dipped his pen in thought. In this other one, Aristotle, when he wrote of interpretation, dipped his pen in thought. According to this tradition, the work grounding the Western conception of linguistic signification, that is to say, Aristotle's On Interpretation, and its link to thought was written, quote, by dipping a pen in thought, unquote. Thought was able to write about the relation between language and thought and between thought and the world only by referring purely to itself, filling its pen with the ink of its own opacity. What is the origin of this striking metaphor? What in Aristotle's text could have authorized the image of a writing of thought? And what would such a writing be? A comparison between thought and the act of writing is contained in the famous passage of De Anima on the soul, in which Aristotle likens the potential intellect to a writing tablet on which nothing is written. The mind, nous, quoting now Aristotle, is like a writing tablet on which nothing is actually written. This famous image of a tabula rasa, or rather, as Alexander of Aphrodisias suggests, of a rasum tabulae, that is, of the light stratum of wax on which the pen inscribed characters, is contained in the section of De Anima devoted to the potential or passive intellect, nous patheticos. Okay, by the way, those of you who follow me for my work on Dugin, if you've gotten this far, you should know that we're now in territory that's also equally of interest to Dugin. Okay, the passive and active intellect. Unfortunately, the bulk of Dugin's lectures on that topic are untranslated. The nature of the intellect is such that it is pure potentiality. It, nous, has no other nature than that of being potential, and before thinking, it is absolutely nothing. Okay, that's quoting Aristotle. Nous is thus a potentiality that exists as such, and the metaphor of the writing tablet on which nothing is written expresses the way in which a pure potentiality exists. All potential to be or to do something is, for Aristotle, always also potential not to be or not to do, without which potentiality would always already have passed into act and be indistinguishable from it. This is the thesis held by the Megarians, whom Aristotle explicitly refutes in Book Theta of the Metaphysics. And I have to add here parenthetically that this issue of the potential to be and the potential not to be both being necessary to our thought of potential is also in Agamben's Homo Sacer, okay, playing an important role there. This potential not to is the cardinal secret of the Aristotelian doctrine of potentiality, which transforms every potentiality in itself into an impotentiality. Just as the geometer is a geometer because he's capable of not doing geometry, and just as the kithara player is a kithara player because he's capable of not playing the kithara, so thought exists as a potential not to think, the potential intellect of the medievals, as a writing tablet on which nothing is written. The pure potentiality of thought is a potentiality that is capable of not thinking, that is capable of not passing into actuality. But this pure potentiality, the resum tabulae, is itself intelligible. It can itself be thought. And quoting now De Anima, Aristotle's On the Soul, it, the intellect, is intelligible like other intelligibles. It is in the light of this conception of potentiality that we must read the passage of De Anima in which Aristotle repeats the argument of Book Lambda of the Metaphysics concerning thinking that thinks itself. Quote, when the mind, the potential intellect, has actually become all of the intelligibles, as the learned man when active is said to do, and this happens when he can exercise his function by himself, even then, the mind is in a sense potential and is then capable of thinking itself. That's end of the Aristotle quote. The thinking of thinking is first of all a potential to think and not to think that is turned back upon itself. Okay, potentiae. Okay, the potential of potential, as it were. Okay, the potential to think that is turned back upon itself. Only on this basis is it possible to comprehend fully the doctrine of Book Lambda on noesos, the thinking of thinking. Pure actuality, that is the actuality of an act, is pure potentiality, that is the potentiality of a potentiality. Okay, that's dense. You probably have to reread it, rethink about it, take it seriously for the rest of your life. The apothegm, is that how you say that? The apothegm on the scribe of nature who dips his pen in thought thus acquires its proper sense as the image of a writing of potentiality. Aristotle could write his logical works, that is, those that treat the pure potentiality of thought and language, only by dipping his pen in nous, that is, in pure potentiality. Potentiality which turns back on itself is an absolute writing that no one writes. Here you can think about the pen that having written and all that. A potential to be written, which is written by its own potential not to be written. A tabula rasa that suffers its own receptivity and can therefore not write itself. Think about that. According to Albert the Great's felicitous intuition in his commentary on De Anima, it is as if the letters wrote themselves on the tablet. Next section is called matter. It is in the context of this writing of the potentiality that no one writes that we must situate Derrida's concept of the trace and its aporias. By the way, this shows you, not only when you think about Derrida do you think about mysticism, but you're also in the realm of Aristotle and the problem of the intellect. The trace is nothing other than the, and by the way, if you dismiss Derrida, you know, for all the reasons that you might, you risk getting, you know, you risk dismissing thought-provoking reflections on both the notion of the intellect in Aristotle and these other notions. Okay, this is my sort of pitch for Derrida. Not that we need one this far into our time together. The trace is nothing other than the most rigorous attempt to reconsider against the primacy of actuality and form the Aristotelian paradox of potentiality. the gesture of the scribe who dips his pen in thought and writes solely with his potentiality not to write. The trace, writing without presence or absence, without history, without cause, without arche, without telos, is not a form, nor is it the passage from potentiality to actuality. Rather, it is a potentiality that is capable and that experiences itself, a writing tablet that suffers not the impression of a form, but the imprint of its own passivity, its own formlessness. But everything is then once again complicated, as though he needed to tell us that. For what can it mean to think neither a thing nor a thought, but a pure potential to think? A name, neither objects nor referential terms, but the pure dunamis, dunamis of speech, to write neither texts nor letters, but the pure potential to write. What does it mean to experience a potentiality, to experience a passivity, if the words experience and passion still have meaning here? Does the aporia of self-reference, which the writing of potentiality aimed to resolve, not then return once again? You know, well-kept cigars are not supposed to go out every 2 seconds. That's all right, though. That's on me. A passage from Plotinus's treatise called On the Two Matters. Okay, now we're Plotinus. We've got Plotinus on the table now. Okay, a passage from Plotinus's treatise On the Two Matters poses precisely these questions. How, Plotinus asks, is it possible to conceive of a non-form and an indetermination? How is it possible to grasp what has neither size nor form? Only through an indetermination will it be possible to conceive of an indetermination. Now, before I read the passage in Plotinus, you should know, before I knew any Derrida, before I'd probably even heard the name Derrida, well, okay, maybe not that far, but certainly before I'd heard or read any Derrida, as a first-year undergraduate at the University of Winnipeg, when I was writing about mysticism, having been steeped in it before entering the university, I had recourse to some passages in Plotinus as the classical statement of the mystical aporia. And, you know, 20 years later, 30 years later, however long it's been, not 30, closer to 20, here he is again, but now in the context of language, mysticism, Heidegger, Derrida, Agamben. So let's see, what does Plotinus say? What then is this indetermination in the soul? Does it amount to an utter absence of knowledge, as if the soul or mind had withdrawn? No. The indeterminate has some footing in the sphere of affirmation. The eye is aware of darkness as a base capable of receiving any color not yet seen against it. So the mind, putting aside all attributes perceptible to sense, all that corresponds to light, comes upon a residuum which it cannot bring under determination. It is thus in the state of the eye which, when directed towards darkness, has become in some way identical with the object of its spurious vision. There is vision, then, in this approach of the mind toward matter? He asks, okay, question mark. Some vision, yes, of shapelessness, of colorlessness, of the unlit, and therefore of the sizeless. More than this would mean that the soul is already bestowing form. But is not such a void precisely what the soul experiences when it has no intellection whatever? No. In that case, it affirms nothing, or rather has no experience. But in knowing matter, it has an experience, what may be described as the impact of the shapeless. Okay, that's the end of the Plotinus quote. Back to Agamben. In the dark, the eye does not see anything, but is, as it were, affected by its own incapacity to see. In the same way, perception here is not the experience of something, a formless being, but rather perception of its own formlessness, the self-affection of potentiality. Between the experience of something and the experience of nothing, there lies the experience of one's own passivity. The trace is, from the beginning, the name of this self-affection. And what is experienced in this self-affection is the event of matter. The aporias of self-reference thus do not find their solution here, rather they are dislocated, and according to the Platonic suggestion, transformed into euporias. Okay, the subtitle of my first essay on Leo Strauss, incidentally, was something about aporia to euporia. The name can be named and language can be brought to speech because self-reference is displaced onto the level of potentiality. What is intended is neither the word as object nor the word insofar as it actually denotes a thing, but rather a pure potentiality to signify, not to signify, the writing tablet on which nothing is written. But this is no longer meaning's self-reference, assigns signification of itself. Instead, it is the materialization of a potentiality, the materialization of its own possibility. Matter is not a formless quid aliquid whose potentiality suffers an impression. Rather, it can exist as such because it is the materialization of a potentiality through the passion of its own impotentiality. Okay, hopefully with all of these elaborations, you're starting to get the sense of the quote-unquote logic at play here, and maybe even experiencing your own experience of language as I read and you listen, or you read and think alongside. The potential to think experience itself, let me say it again. The potential to think experiencing itself and being capable of itself as potential not to think makes itself into the trace of its own formlessness, a trace that no one has traced, pure matter. In this sense, the trace is the passion of thought and matter. Far from being the inert substratum of a form, it is, on the contrary, the result of a process of materialization. In the Timaeus, Plato gives us the model of such an experience of matter. Kora, place, or rather non-place, which is the name he gives to matter, is situated between what cannot be perceived and what can be perceived. So what can't be perceived is the ideal, what can be perceived is the sensible or the perceptible. Neither perceptible nor imperceptible matter is perceptible, I'll read you the English, okay? Matter is perceptible in a paradoxical formulation that must be translated as with the absence of perception, okay? Matter is perceptible with the absence of perception, okay? Kind of like in the example of the darkness, right? The unseeable was graspable with the presence of the unseeable, something like that, okay? But here you have this version of it that, to repeat, matter is perceptible with the absence of perception. Kora is thus the perception of an imperception, the sensation of an anaesthesis, a pure taking place in which truly nothing takes place other than place. This is why Aristotle develops his theory of matter as potentiality on the basis of Timaeus's kora. Like the eye when it is confronted with darkness, the faculty of sensation, we read in De Anima, can sense its own lack of sensation, its own potentiality. So you have a whole set here of related notions, okay, ranging from Plato's kora to the discussion in De Anima, to, as we're presumably going to return to, the Kabbalistic text, and to Derrida's trace. Potential thought, the Neoplatonists speak of two matters, one sensible and one intelligible. Potential thought, the writing tablet on which nothing is written, can thus think itself. It thinks its own potentiality, and in this way makes itself into the trace of its own formlessness, writes its own unwrittenness while letting itself take place in separating itself. Derrida's trace, neither perceptible nor imperceptible, the remarked place of a mark, pure taking place, okay, all these different ways you can characterize it that he's gone over, is therefore truly something like the experience of an intelligible matter. The experience of language that is at issue in grammatological terminology does not, as a common misunderstanding insists, authorize an interpretive practice directed toward the infinite deconstruction of a text, nor does it inaugurate a new formalism. Rather, it marks the decisive event of matter. And in doing so, it opens onto an ethics. Whoever experiences this ethics and in the end finds his matter can then dwell, without being imprisoned, in the paradoxes of self-reference, being capable of not writing. Thanks to Aher's obstinate dwelling in the exile of the Shekinah, Rabbi Akiba can enter the paradise of language and leave unharmed. Okay, now, just like I said, we could probably spend an hour or several hours on the opening paragraph. No doubt we could do so on these closing lines as well. But we're 1 hour and a bit into the presentation. I'm now into the early hours of the night. and I have to leave something unsaid and unstated that can be there for you. And so we'll leave it at that, maybe just one time rereading this final sentence. Thanks to Ahir's obstinate dwelling in the exile of the Shekinah, Rabbi Akiba can enter the paradise of language and leave unharmed. You know, and maybe, as I told you, I was once and still am very attracted to the figure of Akiba, never really paid much attention to the others. Just, you know, you don't want to enter paradise and go crazy. You don't want to enter paradise and die and never return. You know, entering in peace and leaving in peace. That's kind of what I was related to myself. And I think the fact that Derrida became important for me and remains important for me in this unexpected way may surprisingly be a sort of biographical, in my case, indication of the relationship between a quote-unquote Akiba and quote-unquote Ahir, the cutting of the branches and the entering and leaving of the paradise of language unharmed. So that was Giorgio Agamben's essay Pardes. I should tell you, I suppose, where the source is, where it's published. So if you ever want to find it for yourselves, you can. It is, well, I just found it by Googling it, okay, but you should know the book in which it occurs. There's got to be a faster way to the top, huh? Hang on a second. You should know where I got this from, right? It's from a book called Potentialities, Collected Essays in Philosophy. Okay, there you go. Potentialities, Agamben, Pardes. Good night.